Oh, good evening, everyone. So we are here tonight together, practicing the way with gratitude. The thought's been going through my mind, that theme, I guess, and practicing this week with, since it's Thanksgiving week. It's, and since we have almost a full moon tonight, and it'll be tomorrow night, but we'll feel its influence also on Thanksgiving. And I hope it's clear where Angie is, and she's also enjoying the moon. So we have a chance to look at refining our lives again through Uchiyama's wonderful way with talking about this. Talking about this practice. And we're on chapter 3 of Uchiyama's commentary, The True Form of the Self. So, and as usual, Uchiyama gets right to the point. He's so able to just get immediately to the point. He goes over a little detail about what he did the last time, but then he said, since the Tenzo Kokyun, since instructions to the cook, goes into detail about how we can refine our lives through the practice of Zazen, that brings us to the question of what is Zazen? Right to the point. Okay, here's the first question. What is it? And then he has a passage from the Shobogenzo, and the particular edition which I don't have, that I don't know if Angie has. I will have a note to ask her. It's as far as I can tell the Japanese language edition, but there may be a later translation that's come along since this book, the Choenji. And he quotes this in a way that I hadn't heard before except through this book, through his work. Zazen is the true form of the self. So Zazen is the true form of the self. So that brings up the question is, what is the self? And he goes on to quote further from the Genjo Koan. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. And of course the rest of that phrase goes, to study the self is to forget the self. And when the self is forgotten, the myriad things appear. So what is the self? What is this true form of the self that we're looking at? So I think, as he points out in several ways, and I'll read some of those, we kind of have a misunderstanding of the self. We think the self is, in a way, what we've accumulated, what we've put on, all the different parts of ourself, which is what we need to do as human beings, that's the way we are. But what is the true form of the self underneath all these? We often misunderstand that. I think that all the expressions of self that we learn in our lives and take to ourselves, I am this way, I am that way, I like this, I don't like that, I like all the sensations that come to us, all the ideas that come to us, we start to make distinctions about in relation to what we think of as a self, so we can be in the world with all the other selves that are also making these distinctions. And our particular culture is very much geared toward that. It's geared toward understanding the self as this accumulation of preferences, of likes and dislikes. And we're trained in that very early on as children, you know, and this is natural once again. Well, do you like that? Do you not like that? Joey likes Brussels sprouts, as distinct from most of the 5-year-olds at Thanksgiving who will not particularly like their Brussels sprouts. So that's the way we are, and that's all fine and well. But what is the true form of the self? So how do we understand that? Except we're talking about Zazen and how that lets us help understand that. The one of the problems is, which Uchiyama points out, is that we get too attached to these likes and dislikes. And this happens at an unaware level, so that we just think, that's me, that's Carolyn. I like tart flavors. We like ideas, we like sensations, we like, you know, where we have a choice, not even the built-in ones. Of course, no one likes pain. That's really programmed in, hardwired, but where we have a choice, I like this. We like ideas. I like freedom as an idea. And they can be wonderful or not, or we can not like things, but we have a way of gripping on to those likes and dislikes that really leads us into confusion and not understanding what our self really is. That's different from all these forms of the social personality constructed self, if you were. It seems like odd that we forget how we're all actually completely unique. It's like we make these senses of self, as particularly again in our culture, like such a unique individual. But we're actually, what, almost 8 billion people on the planet, and each one is unique, has a unique set of genetic material, and has a unique, you know, environment. Even twins. I have some good friends who are twins, and they are really different. They're identical twins. They're men, but they are really different, and they pretty much were raised in the same environment and to a certain age, but they have totally different ways at this age in their 60s of being in the world and expressing themselves, and have followed different paths in life, work, and relationship, and everything. So it's sort of strange that we forget that we're each unique. But that has real consequences about our being in the world, which Uchiyama goes into. And some of them are just so funny. He's just so funny. You know, then he does this little quote from the newspaper advice column: "My present marriage is an arranged one, but I've really fallen in love with a person for the first time, and I want to marry her. Tell me what I should do." People often whine about some ridiculous problem like this, you know, but perhaps I give the impression that I have not, but this isn't the case. When I was young, I suffered the same kind of problem. I anguished terribly and wound up killing 2 women in my life with whining. I mean, what a phrase, killing. You have to give Thomas Wright some credit for that translation, I think, but killing 2 women in my life with whining. Which one shall I choose? You remember that song from the 60s? Did you ever have to make up your mind? Choose one and leave the other behind. You know. So then he goes on to say, I realize the problem lies in the area of the word really. So in how we convince ourselves of this is really true, this is really me. And the really funny part about this example is that is that in both cases, the person who write to the wrote to the advice column and Uchiyama's own story, is they believed really they were really in love, but they were completely deluded. I mean, it was completely unreal, the situation. It wasn't like, so it's sort of strange that. But then he goes on to lay out how this has real consequences in all of our relationships and in our family, in our work, and even in our social and political world, and how this is basically this holding on to thinking this is real and true and absolute, and I'm right. Or in the case when we're talking about larger groups, tribes to nations, we're right, then this has real consequences. And sadly, history shows us often very unfortunate consequences. So he brings up, he has a nice quote too from Japan's first great Buddhist prince, Shotoku Taishi, who wrote in his constitution of 17 articles, all men have minds of their own, and each man's mind views things differently. So Taishi, without knowing, I'm not sure, this is the only time I've come across his name, I'm not sure when he lived, but even without knowing about DNA, most likely, he got that, you know, we are all unique and we all have different minds. And naturally, we're all going to view things different. We're all going to see things differently. When another is right, I am wrong. When I am right, others is wrong. I am not necessarily wise, and others are not necessarily fools. We are all just ordinary men. We are all just ordinary people. There's a phrase from Shin Buddhism, Pure Land Buddhism, that I really like and that I found useful at certain points in my practice when I found myself or find myself, you know, really hanging on to a position, just another foolish being. I just love that. Just another foolish being. And the Shin, we are all just foolish beings. We are all, you know, stumbling along, and we can be very foolish. We can delude ourselves. So we keep circling back to that's the point of doing zazen. That's why we're practicing. He says, zazen returns us to sanity. So we begin to see by practice, continuous practice, or continually practicing, keeping up with practice, keeping on with practice, that we're all in the same boat. We're all, and just by sitting down and doing zazen, putting ourselves in that place of, as we chant in the Heart Sutra, Mushotoku mind, of not the mind of not gaining or the mind of not clinging, and we see that we're not, we don't have to hold on so tightly. We don't have to become so that I'm right and always right and wise and the others are wrong and foolish. When we do zazen, we let go of all that and gain a freshness, a true sanity. That alone is the true form of the self. In the and then he says in the instructions to the cook, this is referred to as magnanimous mind or big mind. And then he has some very funny things to say about that too. In Buddhism, when the term Daishin, big mind, is used, it is never means big as compared to small. if we think about it in terms of comparisons, we really get in trouble. Compared with an electron, for example, a flea's balls are enormous. But comparing them to a whale, the whale is obviously much larger. So I just love a mind that can come up with a metaphor like that, a simile like that. You know, and then he goes on and he takes it out compared with the Earth. The whale is very small, and he goes on into the galaxies and the universe. And is the universe the biggest thing? He asks rhetorically. Hardly, since the scale of the universe is nothing more than a concept in our minds. And what are we as human beings but a kind of fungus that lives on the surface of the earth? So if we start comparing, you know, we can end up with very funny things like this, or very serious things. Magnanimous means to stop making comparisons. Stop thinking of only in terms of dualities. And then he lists the dualities, black and white, evil and good, right and wrong, heaven and hell, love and hate, enlightenment and delusion. So, as Sing San, the sixth Buddhist ancestor said in Shinshin Ving, the verses of the faith mind, to just to set aside discriminations, one is able to follow the way. The problem arises, as Uchiyama points out. It's very nice to talk about, you know, setting aside distinctions and not doing dualities, but is that just another idea that we can hold on to? Because the problem arises concerns the meaning of not discriminating. In our lives, it is impossible to live without discriminating between good and evil, likes and dislikes. In saying that giving is important does not mean that we go around giving our house key to a burglar, for example. So that has real meaning for what the world we live in and how can we meet that world. Just recently, the Islamic State isn't going away just because we don't like it or don't, you know, or think it's wrong. And it can, you know, when people notice that talk about it, sometimes it seems like they're kind of feeding that kind of sense of being a sense of a subtler sense of self, of being, which is really kind of a pushing away. Oh yeah, that's horrible, that's evil. It is horrible and evil, but to keep dwelling on that, to keep thinking that way, really sets us apart. And then we can't recognize that those people too who are doing those killings are also people like we are. They are also humans that have heart minds. They maybe can just by example show us how far in one spectrum of delusion we can go. But are we immune from that? There's a way in which we can just shut that off, because it is pretty horrible. And I certainly don't advocate, and don't do myself, watching videos or that are shown on TV or wherever of really horrible acts of violence. I don't think that's wise, but I mean, to me, it calls up a reflection of just like, well, where does, just to try to be aware and through our practice of where our beginningless greed, anger, and delusion arise, and where theirs might, and which of course we can't know that from the outside, but we can perhaps open to a more compassionate view, even of the world the way that it is, which is not always what we like. As Uchiyama says, how can we call people anything but senile whose thinking is so hardened that they believe their own ideas of good or evil are irrefutable? So we could say that's Islamic State folks, but it's wise to just reflect on how much our ideas of what we do is the right thing, that we're wise. Zazen takes this narrow mind of ours and throws it away. It makes the mind more flexible and capable of seeing it from a broader perspective. He has another metaphor in here for magnanimous mind, which is that it's as stable as a mountain and as broad as the ocean. And perhaps that is a perspective that we can look at all the confounding and confusing and evil things, but without holding them as without holding it that we're somehow above that or beyond that. So I think I've said enough, and perhaps you all have something to say. I hope so. It's not an easy thing to hold that. The magnanimous mind of Zazen in our daily lives. It's not an easy thing to do. But that's what our practice is.
Ultimately, we don't know the self at all.
Ultimately, I couldn't hear.
We don't know the self at all. And it's best that way. It's a mystery. Not knowing is most content. Bodhidharma once said, vast emptiness, nothing more. So, we live with big mind, but we don't know what it is. But we can feel it. We just can't describe it.
Exactly. It's an experience. We can't define it. We can use these metaphors like Uchiyama is using, and Bodhidharma and Dogen and everyone who's ever said anything about the Buddha himself said that you can't name it, but we can feel it. That's what the Buddha himself also said. If you sit down, sit down and see what you feel. Thank you.
Well, I'm confused. So when we're talking about the self and magnanimous mind, we talk about the big mind. Anyway, so what mind do we consult or open to act? find right action.
That's a most excellent question. That is the question. How do we act in the world? Hopefully from the place of big mind, from our practice. But I mean, I find that that my experience is that the continuous practice, the dwelling in the big mind more through practicing, through zazen, it's the creative place that allows for creative possibility, because the mind isn't narrowed. It isn't saying, this is right. I know how to act because this is right. This is the good action, not the evil action. And I've had this experience in, and I'm sure we all have because we've all practiced, just having like a work situation, or even an action in the body politic, or even what to do in the case when your country is going to war and you don't believe it, for example. Or many simpler, just day-to-day things of relationship in work or in family, that if you that mind will come up, and you'll be surprised how another possibility occurs when that mind arises. I guess another way to say that is, or another aspect of it, is that it's trusting that mind will be there. Because really the social conditioning and the patterning as our beings, as animals and herd animals is to not trust that. It's to like go for the herd, that's how we get into wars, because it's sort of comforting when we all say, oh, those are the bad guys. In this case, IS, but you know, it was the Jews in Germany. It was like, we could go on and on with examples. And then we go, yeah. Because everybody's in the herd going, yes, yes. So in a way we don't, it's not easy to do. How do we find that? The best I can say is that the magnanimous mind of practice, of zazen, is an open one that allows creative action possibilities to arise.
I can agree with that on an individual action, but if you're like working in a group setting, trying to take social action or political action or something, I guess all you can do is contribute your insight, your personal insight.
Well, I think you can find like-minded people too, and that's how things change. And there are like-minded people who, I have a very close friend and relative actually who has started work with the Citizens for Climate Change group, which has they follow certain procedures of completely non-confrontational language and not violence. They do political action. They give testimony in front of Congress, but they have really, they have made a conscious effort to not move from a place of fear or contraction or small mind, but to say, okay, this is how we're going to approach this. So, and there are like-minded people in other areas, I think, that we can, and we probably maybe had in the past. I certainly can remember during the Vietnam War, and even in recent wars. So Not that it means that we are necessarily going to change anything, or that we, but that's all what we can do. And we certainly have plenty of examples from Martin Luther King to Nelson Mandela to Gandhi to many, many other leaders who also hew in some way to this sense of big mind, who say that it's nonviolent action, it's action, it's love, it's action of non-confrontation. It's not a Zen Buddhist way of talking about it, but this large mind allows all these other possibilities to come up, I think. Thank you, Wendy.
Well, I feel moved and inspired to give thanks for this opportunity to sit with my six friends here and talk about these things which come from this interior realm that we are moved to talk about and to consider and reflect on. And having tongues that we can use and ears that we can listen with. I was thinking about what you said about what we can do. And a lot of what I've been reflecting on is what one person can do. And that's really the movement. It's the movement of one person. And when it's collective, it becomes even more powerful. But whatever we ever talk about, the conversation of racism has come up quite a bit in the circles that I've been in. And of course, world politics. But in both of those areas, I find that exactly the position of big mind becomes incredibly important in that discussion, because you can add your thought when it comes from that place, and add to a different understanding of some of those issues. And my practice extends into all these various areas we talk about, especially action, and talking about how we talk to one another, what we may gain by that conversation. So I find that what I do here on Tuesday evenings is so critical to what we're talking about, and what I do at home. But I love this opportunity to sit and have that discussion and see where it takes us. And it is such a mystery. We never know how that next moment's going to unfold. Surprising and mysterious as it is. So. But I want to thank you. I want to thank all of you tonight for being here so we could have this conversation before Thanksgiving.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey. Thank you all for just feeling a lot of thankfulness. You said that beautifully, for the ears and for the tongue and for these. It is a very special place that nourishes us to be out in the world, as you said, Jeffrey. But here's where we get the nourishment in a way, and a kind of gives us the courage to trust ourselves, to speak our voice. And something you said really made me think of conversations I've had on difficult issues with people of a social nature, like racism and global politics, or even climate change, that sometimes the mystery is in, we don't know how just the tone of our voice, just the fact that we're willing to say something in a certain way, it may not be what we say, but that resonates with people, and people feel that difference when we're speaking from a big mind. They definitely do. So, and I also think it's fine if we are silent too, because we don't always find like-minded people. We may not find them in this realm or that realm or the area we're most interested in.
Well, I find when I'm in a group outside of this place, I talk a little louder. Can you talk loud?
Well, people do talk loudly often, and I'm sometimes getting to the point where I'm grateful for that, and I can hear them well.
Yeah.
But thank you, Wendy. Well, we've talked quite a bit tonight, so thank you all.
All the way.
Not wet right now. But are there announcements or anything before we do a 1 minute sit?
And who's on for next week? If you
I'm going to be Dawn.
Okay, and then Jeffrey, I think you're opening.
Next week.
Is it next week? Let me see. Next week, I'm not here, so we're really short. Staff,
and,
that's right.
And I also won't either. So.
Carolyn, Marie, Judy, and Ellie's not here either. So Jeffrey's opening, Wendy's Dohan, and Samia's Makupio.
But Angie will be here.
Yes. We hope.
We hope there's no.
Overdo it.
And that there are no rainstorms in Texas.
Yeah. Yeah.